Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay from Chicago, and I will be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, September 14th, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, September 12th, are the following for the 7:00 A.M. Eastern Standard Time meeting. That number is 22,780. That's 22780. For the 10:00 A.M. meeting, 22,781. That's 22781. This morning, A Vision for You presents 10-Step Perspectives, Food for Thought. These speakers are going to be really glad. I'm going to keep it brief because I want to get to the good stuff here. Why did we choose to study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous anyway, known as we lovingly refer to it as the Big Book? I mean, that's what we do at this meeting, right? We, of course, study the Big Book line by line, paragraph by paragraph, page by page. To that point, if you were to go on the Vision for You website and you were to click on the tab About Us, you know those tabs, About Us, About This, About That? Here's what it'll say, just the first sentence. It says, and I quote, "Here at A Vision for You, we study the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous." To me, no mumbo jumbo, nothing flashy here in that, just a simple program of action to not die from this disease. It doesn't say that, by the way. That's my little bit. That's how I look at this, is I don't want to die from this disease. You'll find a little bit more about us on the website. It says, "Overeaters Anonymous is a fellowship of individuals who share experience, strength, or their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem." That always strikes me. That's what binds us together. We have a common problem, and we have a common solution. What if we can find a way out of the quicksand? What if we could find a way where we could stop killing ourselves with food? I didn't think it was possible, but in the foreword to the first edition in the Big Book, we find a sentence that's very crystal clear to me. It says, "To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book." Now, here's a pretty cool fact that I'll finish with. You know what sparks the need for change in a compulsive overeater who, like me, perhaps you, a person who's afflicted with this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body? Page 27 tells me. It says, "I need a huge emotional displacement and rearrangement where my ideas, my emotions, attitudes, which were once the guiding force of my life, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate me." You know what we call that process that brings that about? I hear Leah saying it because she used to say it. She's cringy. Recovery, Larry. That's what we call it, recovery. Joining us this morning to share their insights on step 10 are Jason K. and Pete B. Unless they moved recently, that's always possible. They're both from Pennsylvania, but they'll tell me if they're not. Both of these recovered gentlemen are devoted to the 12 steps and 12 traditions and carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. Jason and Pete will each speak for approximately 15 minutes on step 10. Additionally, they'll have a sort of a point-counterpoint discussion about this step, referring to the text and its suggested instructions. Let's get right to it. First up, please join me in welcoming Jason K. to the line this morning. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning, Larry Kay. Yes, Pete and I are both from California, but I'm currently in Colorado. So Jason K.P., recovered compulsive eater and bulimic. I just wanted to introduce myself for those who don't know me. I came into the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous when I was approximately 20, maybe 21 years old, very confused, having had a very troubled, difficult relationship with food and compulsive eating behaviors and sort of the early stages of bulimia, making myself throw up after overeating. Fast forward 17 years from age 20 to 37, the disease got worse. My eating got worse. My periods of control, or seemingly to control the disease got shorter and shorter. My life got progressively unmanageable, more unmanageable, more chaotic, more unpredictable in terms of my ability to, live functionally as an adult. Around September 22nd of 2017, after coming home from the Vision for You conference, there was a huge transformation and surrender, having had seen people at the conference face to face and saw, similar to what Bill saw with Ebbie Thatcher, a living miracle in front of me, something in people's countenance that was speaking of a depth, a twinkle in their eye, a spiritual experience had happened, and a certain conviction and emotion and sincerity and depth in their voice, and a powerful testimony to the power of recovery. I came home from that conference and ate compulsively and threw up. The very same night I left, Sunday morning at the conference, Sunday night in the food. This sort of dichotomy and sort of tension of knowing recovery was possible and still eating compulsively allowed for some sort of deep surrender that I didn't consciously do on Thursday, September 22nd of 2017. And since then, I identify as a recovered compulsive eater, still growing in understanding and effectiveness, working on maintaining my spiritual fitness with a daily reprieve, a stay of execution, by maintaining a connection with my higher power and maintaining a spiritual awakening. And step 10 is a really important step for me. So I was on a recent meeting and I shared like a brief 5-minute point, conversation sort of thoughts on step 10. And Pete happened to be in that same meeting and shared his perspective. And I always find Pete's perspective very thoughtful, very considered, and often referencing our literature. And he's consistently asked interesting and sometimes challenging questions. And in the past, we have discussed the big book kind of back and forth. What do you think this means? What do you think that means? So we are going to do a little bit of a point counterpoint presentation, because when Pete, kind of says some of those things, I'm excited to kind of, share my point of view, and, quote the literature or think about the history, of the fellowship and how we developed these things. We do have this sort of the book and the exact directions, and then we have how we sort of interpret and live those instructions, and how we form certain cultural kind of norms around the book and the fellowship. And that's kind of interesting for me to look at some of those things. And for me, Larry's talking about come out of the big book, we study the literature. That's really, really important. And another experience with Pete that comes to mind and was very, very profound for me is he was giving a special edition and talking about, I believe, this exact paragraph we'll get into. And a person asked a question and said, "I think it means this." And Pete, read the text, and "I think it means this." And they were literally reading the same exact words and had a disagreement on their interpretation. And I thought, wow, if we can really disagree that much when we're looking at the text, that's really important to stay close to that text, because there's a lot of studying the exact words and understanding it, and sticking to that. So I just want to briefly share about my history with the 10th step. Before I had experienced this deep step one, this 10th step was confusing, and this concept of inventory was confounding. It didn't really seem to shift anything for me. It didn't really make sense to me. I had people share a 10th step with me, for instance, and they're like, "That's how you do a 10th step." And I was like, fine, sure. Didn't seem to make much sense to me. And when I practiced or tried doing 4-step inventories to get recovered, and I hadn't really had a first step experience, the inventory was just lacked a certain depth, lacked a certain effectiveness. When I finally had a deep step one experience and I was working the steps to save my life, in a sense, because I could not continue on the way I was continuing on, I was heading towards self-destruction, and I became willing to go to any lengths, and I became teachable. The 10th step was a revelation to me. The fourth step, and I linked the fourth and the 10th step because the 10th is a continuation, continuing to take personal inventory. You know, it was revelatory for me. It was absolutely, you know, seismic, tectonic plate types of shifts for me to do inventory and to do 10 steps, you know, deep, deep shifts in perspectives and seeing things in an entirely different way. And it's powerful and it's profound. And going to inventory practice without first understanding and, you know, going through steps 1 through 3, jumping into 4 is not going to have that effect if steps 1 through 3 aren't in place. And then continuing to take inventory, you know, you're ensconced and sort of embraced in this paradigm of steps 1 through 9, clearing away the wreckage, seeking to grow in understanding and effectiveness, seeking to get close to our higher power. By the way, Larry, I'm timing myself, so we'll that 15 minutes may be closer to 20, and Pete's aware of that too. His might be the same. So the focus of our talk is this part of the book where it says, this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory. And the thought which takes us there, he's talking about the step 9 promises and, you know, this, you know, being amazed before we're halfway through. It says, we vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So as we're doing our amends, you know, cleaning up the past, we're doing step 10, 11, and 12, this sort of like the way of life steps. We've entered the world of our spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime, to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So again, just to frame this, right, I like to talk about spirituality in the big book and the 12 steps in a very practical way. So when I wake up in the morning, that's setting an intention to pray and meditate. The big book instructs us to think about the 24 hours ahead, to ask God to divorce our thinking from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. You know, we set out in the world to be of service. Love and service is our code. You know, what is God's will for us? Throughout that day, if we become agitated or doubtful, we pause, we ask God for the next right thought or decision, thought or action, right? So for me, as I go through the day with that intention to be of service, to better do God's will, I'm often triggered either distinctly by somebody cutting me off in traffic, for instance, a very distinct moment in time, or sort of a general drift into worry, fear, anger, resentments, and so forth. And for me, this is, you know, falling off the beam, right? So I'm off the track in the morning. I set myself on this track. I turn my heart, my mind, my spirit, my soul. I open towards God. I commit and affirm. I'm going to live a spiritual life today. I've given my life to God. And I'm going to continue on that path. I thank God for my recovery. I do my morning meditation. And then you'll notice, you know, we get off the beam here. We can do our step 10. And then it ends with love and tolerance of others is our codes. We resolutely turn our thoughts to other people we can help. That, for me, getting back on the beam. For me, turning my thoughts to someone I can help, being of service, is my intention all day, every day. When I fall off of it, I do the 10th step, I come back to it. So that's kind of practically framing it in sort of like a practical spirituality. In the literature, it's found in a chapter, Into Action, and the big book is constantly telling us, you know, action and more action. Even when it gets to step 11, it says more action is recommended, and it even describes meditation in the form of action. So we vigorously commence this way of life. As we clean up the past, we're commencing this way of life. And again, I think of this as a continuation as we continue to take personal inventory. Now, Bill doesn't say, you know, go do a step 4 and write it down and blah, blah, blah. You know, he gives us a little bit of a different sort of sense of this continued inventory. And I just want to point out that historically, you know, reading some of the history, like Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and AA Comes to Age, helps me frame my understanding of this book and helps me frame sort of my interpretations. Because we talk about work the steps fast. Is that in a day? Is it hours, days, weeks, months? So my understanding is Dr. Bob would officially take people through the steps in an afternoon, but often in the early days, people would, detox for a couple days, get sort of like a talking to, and people would sort of testify and talk about their stories and introduce the program of action. They'd have like a day or so to contemplate. Then they'd make a decision, step three, and they'd be writing inventory and launching into amends. It's like a very quick process, a matter of days. So to me, 10 steps aren't meant to be like, we go through the first 9 steps in, 6 months and, oh, I'm not allowed to do a 10th step yet. So for me, historically, my sponsor started me doing 10 steps like relatively quickly within like a week or two, I believe. And those 10 steps were really, really powerful for me, when my world seemed kind of upside down and everything was kind of crashing in on me, he would calmly say, we have a process for this. It's step 10. Jason, where are you being selfish here? Where are you being fearful, dishonest, or resentful? Oh, and I'd get those things out, and that sort of those aspects of self that were blocking me would be released, and I'd get closer to my higher power. Back on this beam, so to speak, the train would be, instead of being derailed, the train would be going down the track. So I wanted to focus, on these practical components. And again, there are some parts of our culture, our fellowship, that we develop these little patterns or sort of like rituals and rules and norms. And, I just wanted to talk about some of those and how I practically go through step 10s in my day-to-day life and what has worked for me. So I have sort of a number of points along those lines. So when I take and give 10 steps, sometimes I hear people say, well, I'm not recovered. I'm not recovered. Maybe I'm not allowed to take your 10th step. And, I go back to the book when it says in the 5th step, we're looking for a person that can keep a confidence and they fully understand and approve what we're driving at. So I ask that person, like, can you keep a confidence and do you understand and approve of what I'm trying to do? If they say yes, I encourage them to take my 10th step, and I'm happy to share that. And again, that's another way of just coming out of the book, right? We don't need to make up these rules that you can't take a 10th step unless you're recovered. At least that's my perspective on this. Another sort of cultural practices we have is formats, right? People said, do you have a format? Do you have a format? For me, like, it's important to follow, the instructions as best I can out of the big book. And, structure is comforting and it feels safe sometimes, but for me, it also feels constraining. And again, if a format, like something written down or, do this first and this second and that third is helpful for you, more power to you. Typically, like, I've struggled to have a format because it feels constraining. Sometimes I hear formats and people have like, and I've been sent formats with like lists of like flavors of selfishness and like different ways dishonesty can manifest and, like really, really detailed lists. And they're, they're edifying for me. They open my eyes to certain manifestations, subtle manifestations of selfishness. But I tend not to use those on a day-to-day basis. And sometimes when people read through a format, I hear it's this sort of like rote, sort of like it just, I don't feel emotionally connected, to the feelings they're experiencing or, what is that fear? Like it doesn't feel as quite real or authentic to me. So I prefer not to use a format. I kind of try to speak from my heart. Yes, I have 10 steps that are a little bit messy. But I need that because I have this certain perfectionism. There were times in my recovery where I said, oh, I got to write down my 10th step. And I hear people sometimes say they feel guilty. Oh, I didn't write down my 10th step. I just want to point out that the big book does not say in step 10, we pick up a pen and paper and put a pen to paper to do our 10th step. And I always let people know that. Like, you shouldn't feel guilty. The big book doesn't tell you. You have to write down your 10 steps. Now, again, if this is helpful for you, more power to you. But I try more and more as I go through my recovery, I try to come out of the big book more precisely, referring back to it again and again. And I think when we have questions about, step 10, how do we do it? you know, I look back to the book. You know, same thing with people say, oh, I'm not recovered. Can I take your 10th step? Well, let's look at the qualifications for a person to take your fourth step, which again is essentially the same qualifications in my mind to take a 10th step. And when I went through a phase, I said, I'm going to write down every 10th step I have. I stopped doing as many 10th steps because I added barriers to doing my 10th step. I'd have to find paper. I'd have to go, you know, go do, pull up a document if I'm doing a digital version. So that's just one point. The other point I wanted to talk about is I get kind of caught up sometimes into feeling better. And sometimes, you know, I'll have people ask me after a 10th step, do you feel better? And it's like, yeah, I do. But for me, it's not really the point, right? I spent a long, long time in my, you know, my selfishness, very, very preoccupied with how I'm feeling, right? I want to feel a certain way. I want to feel good. I was always pursuing like feeling good. And that for me was sort of like the mantra of the addict, right? The selfish perspective. So the big book talks about the aspects of self blocking us from our higher power. You know, it talks specifically about resentments as they cut us off from the sunlight of the spirit, and that, it, you know, we return to alcohol. You know, resentments are deadly because of that. So, you know, it's not about whether I feel better. It's about have I cleared away this wreckage? Sorry, have I cleared away these barriers and blockages? Yes, sometimes I feel more peaceful, but it's not the point. I also just want to bring our attention to the word we discuss. You know, we discuss this with somebody at once. For me, I find the most meaning when I have a discussion. I can sometimes monologue towards people because I have this great feedback and I can give them, you know, this point and remind them of this section of the big book. I can share my own experience, but I try not to monologue to people and I try to be a very active listener, and I appreciate when people listen to me actively. Sometimes people, you know, they'll mute their phone and I feel like I'm talking into a void. So I specifically ask people not to mute. Even if you're washing your dishes and, you know, I feel like I'm right there with you in your kitchen, washing your dishes, hearing that background noise, I feel like I'm with you. So again, that's just a preference for me. I also think just this discussion point and how to give feedback is really, really important. A lot of times I have some sort of rules I made up. Again, not in the big book. This is part of like our cultural practices. But thank you for sharing. And actually in step 4 and 5, it talks about, you know, the sponsor may relate some of their experiences to relate to the person. But thank you for sharing. I also just think for me, it's important to have compassion. You know, if you have a script and, you know, you think you're being selfish, but you're dealing with like death or loss or grief, you know, sometimes I point out there's normal human emotions behind dealing with certain things, and there's a certain compassion for people going through that. The other thing I like to say is I relate, right? Like, I've gone through that. You know, a lot of times people do a 10th step and it's like, I could have done this exact same 10th step. And then the feedback part is really important to me. So for instance, have you considered this, right? I want to always give feedback in a way that stimulates this discussion. Again, we're in this, the instructions talk about we discuss this with somebody at once. And I want to give people a chance to confirm they resonate with my feedback, that it is hitting them on a right level. Or sometimes they can deny it. No, it's not quite that, Jason. It's more like this. Oh, that makes sense. So I try not to monologue at people. I try to give them a little bit of feedback and invite a discussion. And that back and forth and that authentic connection is sometimes really, really, that is usually what I found to be really, really great. The other thing I just want to talk about is length. You know, I do a lot of 10 steps in my car. Sometimes I'm rushing to an appointment. And my GPS says 2 minutes and someone calls me. Sometimes it says 1 minute. And I love to give myself permission to do a 1 or 2 minute 10th step. And for that, I'm very general. You know, I say, oh, I'm really upset and this person cut me off and I'm self-righteous. I'm just going to turn it to God. Okay, God, please help me. Please help me be safe on the roads. Help me be considerate of others. You know, not tailgate, disengage. God help me, right? I keep it really simple and I ask the person for feedback. And for me, I had to give myself permission to not be a perfectionist, to not list selfishness, fear, dishonesty, resentment. So that's really important for me. I did hear an AA speaker talk about a version of a 10th step. You know, the guy calls his sponsor and says, I'm being a jerk. And the sponsor says, knock it off. And then that's the end of their phone call. Probably I need a little bit more than that, especially bringing in the power of prayer. And then last but not least, I'm just going to share this last point. And I think Pete makes some really good comments on, you know, do I run to people, you know, constantly call people all day long and, you know, kind of process things, or do I turn to God, you know, immediately in my soul, in my spirit, and turn to a place of prayer? Because the instructions do say, as we watch for selfishness, fear, dishonesty, and resentment, we ask God to remove them at once, right? And then we can discuss that with somebody and make amends if we have harmed somebody. And one of the things Pete had said is, you know, when do we rely on and really go to prayer versus going to the fellowship? And again, that's, I'm transitioning over to Pete talking here, but I'll just make my little point here, which is I'm constantly in my head having little blips and little moments of, you know, here's a selfish thought, here's a fear-based thought. And I'm constantly turning my thoughts to God, to a higher power. How can I be of service? How can I be helpful? You know, those selfish thoughts are like, well, I want things to go a certain way. You know, we're with family here in Colorado. You know, I want dinner to be, you know, at 6 p.m. and not 7 p.m. So I'm waiting. It's okay. How can I be of service? How can I do God's will, you know, in the hour that I'm waiting? I didn't have to step out and call somebody. There are ways for me of in my head directly turning to my higher power and shifting. And sometimes they're really sticky, and sometimes they're deeper resentment. Sometimes they don't leave. Sometimes maybe it's just a deeper, more kind of pertinent issue. Sometimes I have more, you know, the availability to do a phone call and really talk to somebody about it. And that tends to be more effective. And for me, it tends to be a little more effective to pray with people. But I'm going to put a pin in it. I'm going to let Pete come in here and raise some other interesting points. And I'll probably take a few notes, and we'll do like a little, you know, Pete will talk, and I'll kind of give like a little 5-minute kind of counterpoint or sort of additional thoughts. And then Pete will do the same, and we'll open it for questions. So I'm going to mute and invite Pete to come in.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much. Oops. Thanks, Pete. Okay, great. Can you hear me?
Yes, you could be heard great.
Okay, thanks, sir, great. Sorry about that.
You're coming through, Pete.
Okay,
yep, so, coming through.
Thanks, I appreciate it. So thank you. Thank you, Larry, for your service, and thank you, Jason, for inviting me to this for this special edition. And so just to get started, my name's Pete B. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm in Pennsylvania. I live in Pennsylvania. And before I jump into anything about the 10th step, I just want to say the most important thing that anybody on this line should take away from this talk today is that the 10th step has to be done, right? Step 10 has to be done. Omitting it or failing to do it, just like any of the other steps, is a recipe for disaster, right? So the takeaway is it has to be done, right? You know, we could practice it whatever way we need to practice it, right? But what is practice, right? So practice, the word practice means to perform or exercise a skill repeatedly or regularly to improve or maintain one's proficiency, right? Improve, that's to become better. You know, proficiency is my competence or my you know, my expertise. Right? And competence is the ability to do something successfully or efficiently, right? And the thing that it says in the big book, after we have cleared, or when we begin to clear away the wreckage of our past, is the next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. The word effectiveness means the degree to which something is successful in producing a desired result or success, right? So all of us as individuals, we all have our own ideas about what the desired outcome of this process is, right? It's individual, right? We all have our own understanding of God, and we all are supposed to be arriving at what we think or who we think our God would have us be. So the outcome is whatever it is you decide you want the outcome to be, right? But are we being honest with ourselves? Are we really setting aside what we think we know and what we think other people know to have a new experience? Are we really following what the literature indicates? Right? Am I really using my God-given mental faculties and the intellect and the instincts that have been provided for me? Right? Could I possibly be using these steps as just another expression of self-centeredness? Could it be? I don't know. So just briefly, who I am, right? So I said in my name, look, there's nothing special or significant about my role in OA, right? There's no letters or designations like PhD or Esquire or Doctor or Masters or anything like that following my name. I'm not a historian. I'm not an expert. And I certainly didn't write the big book. I'm just a dude. I'm a compulsive reader that's recovered from this seemingly hopeless condition. Right, and I'm here today in an effort to carry the AA message as I understand it, and as I see that it's written in our big book as well as in the other AA literature, the AA 12 and 12. Right, and also, like, I'm here today because I was invited, just like all the other people that do these special editions. Right, like, I don't speak for AA, I don't speak for OA, I don't speak for a vision for you, I don't speak for anything. I'm offering my perspective and thoughts on a subject, and my only interest is to be helpful, and helpful the only way that I know how to be, right? Only one level in any 12-step anonymous meeting, right? And that's member, and I'm a member, that's it, right? And we stand people up and make them the Q&A person or give them these things, and we come across and they have these facts, and we think, well, they have this obviously different qualification. No, just a member, that's it. I also want to say, if you hear me say anything that conflicts with what the big book says or any other AA literature, you can bring it to my attention, right? I'm here to carry the AA message, not mine, not my message. And I'm a work in progress. I fall short all the time. Right? So you don't have to worry about hurting my feelings. You can bring it up to my attention. You can call me afterwards. You can stop me right in the middle and let me know if something I'm saying is inconsistent with what the literature says. You know, I've been in OA, you know, in some capacity since around 2004 or 2005, right? I've been entirely abstinent since May of 2017, and I've become recovered as I understand it since August of 2017, and I found my way into OA through AA where, you know, I've been free of alcohol since May of 1997, right? And since that time, I've been to AA conventions. I've had step meetings and conducted big book studies and workshops. You name it, and I've done it, right? But I have to say, since being sober in AA to this day, 28.29 years, I have never once been asked by a person in AA if I had time for a 10-step. Why is that? Do AAs work at different 12 steps? Right? Is step 10 different in OA than it is in AA? Right? We're using the same book. And I'm not claiming that AAs are right and OAs are wrong or vice versa. Right? That's not what I'm trying to express. Right? And I'm not offering some anecdotal information as the basis of my perspective either. I'm just offering what my experience has been. And many OA members that also happen to be in AA that I've spoken with have indicated the same or similar thing. Right? So let's just set all that aside for right now and take a look and talk about step 10. So let's talk about what step 10 isn't, right? And Jason mentioned it, right? It's not a turnaround. right? It's also, it's not step four through nine. It's not, right? Because in step four, we're making a searching and fearless moral inventory. In step 10, we're taking a personal inventory, right? And moral and personal are different words with different meanings. This isn't Bill Wilson using different terms to describe the same thing. One of the actual definitions for the word personal is private, right? So what's a personal inventory? A personal inventory is a broad self-assessment of one's thoughts, behaviors, emotions, and actions, often conducted regularly to maintain self-awareness and personal growth. Moral inventory is a deeper, more specific examination of one's moral character, right? It focuses on personal shortcomings, wrongs, ethical behaviors, right? It's tied to our past, right? They're different words. They mean different things. But yeah, obviously, and you know, when we talk about step five, following step four, it says in actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Why is it insufficient? And the reason why it's insufficient is because we're mentally ill at the point when we do this, right? We still have illusions that we're somebody that we're not. We still have delusions, right? In spite of the evidence, we still choose to believe what we want to believe. And we're still plagued with self-deceit. So absolutely, a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, right? But so much happens, right? An experience happens from doing step four to when we're doing the 10th step or step 10. There's a change. There's a transformation that takes place. Right? The 10th step, it involves ongoing self-reflection and accountability, not to somebody else, accountability to me and to the God as I understand God, right? It encourages individuals to regularly assess their thoughts, their actions, their behaviors, and we identify any areas that may have where we may have fallen short or caused harm. Right? When mistakes are recognized, the step emphasizes promptly admitting and addressing them to maintain personal growth and sobriety. You know, the big book, it offers one paragraph on step 10. That's it, right? And to me, that seems a little light for the one step that we all seem to love in OA so much, right? So much that we mention it in almost every single meeting that we're in, regardless of what the topic is. Right. So but we have another source that covers the topic. Right. And that source, it was written 13 years after the big book. Right. That's the AA 12 and 12. Wouldn't it make sense that if there was vital instance relative to the step, like you had to do them, wouldn't it make sense that it would indicate that being the case in the book that was written 13 years later for clarification? Jason mentioned practical. I mean, that seems practical, right? If it was necessary, it would be in there. And what does the AA 12 and 12 say? Well, it says that it's a that the 10th step is a continuous look at our assets and liabilities. Continuous indicates it's a process. It tells us there are all different types of inventories, right? It tells us that there's one we take at day's end. It tells us there's occasions where we take them alone or with somebody else. It tells us that we go to annual or semi-annual house cleanings. It says many of us like the experience of an occasional retreat outside the world so we can quiet down for an undisturbed day. It's telling us that the 10th step, step 10, is a process that we continue to do for all of our days, right? And among many of those inventories is the spot check inventory, right? And it tells us in the 12 and 12, in the AA 12 and 12 on page 89, it says the emphasis on inventory is heavy only because a great many of us have never really acquired the habit of accurate self-appraisal. Once this healthy practice has become grooved, it will become so interesting and profitable that the time it takes won't be missed. It says on 93, in all these situations, we need self-restraint, honest analysis of what is involved, a willingness to admit when the fault is ours, and an equal willingness to forgive when the fault is elsewhere. On page 93, it says, whenever we fail any of these people, we can promptly admit it to ourselves always, to them also, when the admission would be helpful. What's missing there? Page 95, learning daily to spot, admit, and correct these flaws is the essence of character building and good living. An honest regret for harms done, a genuine gratitude for blessings received, and a willingness to try for better things tomorrow will be the permanent assets we shall seek. Right, so that's what the 12 and 12 says about it. So let's talk about the words that are used, right? So we already talked about continue, means we keep going. Right? It says to learn, right? This learning means we're gaining knowledge. Grow, it means that we're increasing, we're changing, we're progressing, we're maturing. Acquire means learn, develop, right? Accurate is correct in all details, exact. Appraisal, an act of assessing something or someone. All of these words that are used in the 12 and 12 as well as the big book, they all imply development. They all imply transformation, change, improvement. And look, me, just like you, I came in here very damaged, very broken, very broken. But this narrative that we stay that way indefinitely, regardless of what happens, unable to use our faculties because we're somehow, some way broken, that's inconsistent with what the literature is. We don't lose our access to the resources and capabilities that the Creator provides us. That comes back. Right? So let's look at the instructions. What do the instructions say in the big book? Right? There's five sentences. Right? It says, continue to watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Period. Right? What? Period signals the end of a complete thought or statement, right? That's what it's telling us to look out for. When these crop up, comma, we ask God at once to remove them, period. It's the end of the thought. That's what we're instructed to do, right? It says we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed someone. Right. Well, we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly. That's a clause. That's a part of a sentence that by itself could make up a sentence and a final thought. But it has a condition and a dependent clause. It says if we have harmed someone. These are not separate instructions. These are a sentence, right? Because it ends with a period. Right. And the word if is a condition. Right, so it tells us when we must discuss them with someone, that someone is the person who our selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear impacted. That we have to talk to somebody about. Right? We have to. It says harmed. Right? Harmed has a definition as well. It means physical injury or material damage, real industry, physical, emotional, spiritual, financial, or relational. Right? That's when, if we've harmed someone, right? It doesn't say if we've hurt someone. Who do we discuss our selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear with? The person that has been impacted or affected by the behavior. When do we do it? Immediately. Right? What I have to understand, we all talk about powerlessness, but guess what? My thoughts, my emotions, they don't have the power to harm anyone but me. Right? But I'm not supposed to be focused on me. It tells us that selfishness, and we have to be rid of it. We're not rid of it by discussing it with other people. We're rid of it by asking God to remove it. So how does somebody acquire a habit of accurate self-appraisal, right? Habits are a behavior or a routine you perform regularly or often automatically with little conscious effort. But, right, it's difficult. It's difficult when we just finished just cleaning up the wreckage of our past. It's difficult. arrive at, like, flip a switch, we've automatically become well, right? Like I said earlier, by definition, we have challenges, right? We have illusions. We're delusional. We have serious mental illness. Even the doctor's opinion says they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, you know, the way we think, the way we behave, that seems like the only normal one, right? But that mental illness, that's insanity. But we don't. But that's how we were. We don't stay that way. Sanity gets restored. We get to use our will. Right on page 86, it says we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Right? Sponsors, fellows, spiritual advisors, they're all there to help, to guide, right? They're not for us to become dependent upon them. Right? If our practice is to, if we develop a practice, or if our habit is to depend on and rely on human resources and outside direction, doesn't that conflict with what the book says? Right? Doesn't page 98 say we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence on other people ahead of dependence on God? I don't know about you. I know this. It's way more difficult to break a bad habit than it is to develop a new one, right? Like, just talk to anybody who plays golf or anybody who bites their nails. It's way more difficult, right? You know, we talk about the capacity to be honest, right? The book talks about honesty. It's talking about self-honesty, right? It's not talking about being honest with you. It's about being honest with myself. Right on page in the 12 and 12 on page 123, it says they finally came up with the conclusion that, you know, like, yeah, we have all those things, illusions, delusions, all those things, right? We're mentally, it says on page 123 that, you know, AA's got doctors and psychologists to do an analysis of alcoholics, right? So in addition to all those things, we're also childish, emotionally sensitive, and grandiose, right? And we have to confront uncomfortable truths about ourselves, our flaws, our mistakes, our biases, and our motivations. And it's tough to admit when we're wrong, driven by ego or acting against our values, right? Because our mind protects itself with defense mechanisms like denial, rationalization, and projection, and that distorts our reality. Because we want to avoid discomfort. And the reason why we wanted to avoid discomfort is because we're human, not because we're addicts or compulsive overeaters. We're naturally wired to avoid pain and seek comfort, right? And it takes persistence, courage, and emphasis, and effort to take an honest look at ourselves. Right? Someone who knew, you know, page on the 12 and 12 on page 93, it says, someone who knew what he was talking about once remarked that pain was the touchstone of all spiritual progress. And this work to become self-honest, right, to learn how to trust and rely in God, that's difficult and it's painful, but it's the touchstone of all spiritual progress. I'm coming up on the end of my time, so I just want to jump into this. So it says sometimes quickly, you know, so self-awareness. There's no magic switch or button that we press to become, you know, where we become aware, right? We don't get to a certain point or a certain step and automatically become capable of self-honesty, right? It's not something that we attain or we never have to revisit, right? We're always going to have to continue to be self-searching and self-seek and self-aware. And only the person, the individual, knows if they have it, right? And objectivity and in the role of others, I'm not minimizing. I'm not negating the value and importance of sponsorship and fellowship and outside resources, right? Those people, they're uniquely qualified. Right on page 18, it says when people are properly armed with the facts about themselves, right? They have certain insight and guidance, and they can provide objectivity. But it says it again on page 98. If the alcoholic contends to rely upon our assistant rather than upon God, we're doing it wrong, right? If we deprive someone of what to go through, we're probably doing more harm than we are good, right? And if we're sitting and worrying through and constantly preoccupied with all of our thoughts, all of our feelings, all of our emotions, how is that not focusing on self? How is that focusing on other people? Right? That's the way out of us. And Jason mentioned it. When if we're spending all this time on our, you know, looking out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, when do we pause throughout the day when agitated and doubtful and ask God for the right direction, the right thought, the right action? When does that happen? I've already gone a little bit over, so I'm just going to say this and, you know, you could chime in again, right? So like I said earlier, we're all free to practice step 10 any way we want, any way that works for us. We can practice any step any way we want to. It doesn't matter to the individual. There are only two places that I know of in the big book that explain why people return to drinking. In page 35 in Jim's story, it says, all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So that tells me if I don't enlarge my spiritual life, I could return to drinking. And on page 70, it says, if we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we're quite sure to drink. If we're implying that if we fail to talk about or process every emotion or feeling with another person, that's going to result in us returning to food, that's disingenuous. And it's inconsistent with what our literature says. And look, the big book has specific instructions, right? We have a role in working with others, and it's not to assign a person a task or a practice that works for us. If something works for us, that's amazing, but it's our job to guide a person through the steps as they are written. We assist them with accountability and honesty, but we're not the person they're accountable to and honest with. We're supposed to model recovery, offer support, not therapy. We're supposed to encourage reliance on a higher power, not on ourselves. And we're supposed to be available in times of difficulty, right? Promoting service and growth. The chapter 7, Work With Others, has specific instructions. On 99, it says, remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It's dependent upon his relationship with God. On 98, it says, the minute we put our work on a service plane, the alcoholic commences to rely upon our assistant rather than upon God. On page 98, it says again, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people ahead of dependence on God. And on 98 again, it says, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trusts in God and clean house. We're not supposed to be offering special forms and workshops on how to do a step that's not in the big book, right? There, you know, we're not, you know, telling somebody that there's a specific way to do a step 10 and a specific way to take a step 10. Well, that's inconsistent with what the literature says. The literature has really specific instructions. We're supposed to be directing people to where their reliance and dependence needs to be. Is it helpful to have an objective, to reach out to somebody and get an objective view about a specific situation? Absolutely. But ultimately, the reliance, the dependence, our recovery depends upon our relationship with God. With that, I'll pass.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate you. Oh, go ahead, Jason.
Yeah. You're passing the baton, Larry. I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm just going to take a couple minutes and just... Yeah, thank you, Pete. You really, really definitely make me think, man. I really appreciate that. You know, you referenced this in step 4, I believe, in the sex inventory. It talks about if our conduct doesn't change and we're still hurting others, we'll continue to drink. These are facts proven. I believe in that same section, it says, you know, counseling, wise counsel with others is good and useful and important, but ultimately the decision is between you and God. And just, yeah, so you're really, really making me think, am I dependent upon God or am I dependent upon, you know, people? And, you know, you made many different quotes about, you know, our trust and reliance is on God. I'm processing through this, and I kind of appreciate, you know, kind of the questions that you brought up. You know, for me, I'm looking at this thing when I really most need God, I'm very disconnected from God. And then I value having somebody else. You know, and sometimes I look at Bill, you know, his use of words, you're right, personal inventory, you know, suggests sort of a private inventory. And I was also reading through the AA 12 and 12 step 10. And I think, you know, what I saw in that is he kind of says, maybe really only in one spot, he says, there are occasions when alone or in the company of sponsors or spiritual advisors, we carefully review our progress. And I was looking at that again in light of your shares, like, we're alone or in the company of our sponsor. But he doesn't say one is better than the other. And he doesn't say, definitely do this. But if you read the entirety, it appears as if, yes, they are. It's a very personal, private practice. A self-assessment is the norm, sort of the way he's kind of, pointing us to. So, yeah. So I look at this question too: the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, right? Like, you know, we're saying like the main point is to do this, and this is a practice. You know, I have a quote from Bill Wilson. He says, and I think I got this out of that, Bill sees it, I don't think we can do anything very well in this world unless we practice it. And I don't believe we can do AA too well unless we practice it. And it says we should practice acquiring the spirit of service. And I kind of cherry picked that because I was focusing on being of service. You know, so this daily practice of self-reflection and inventory and clearing away the wreckage, things that come up. You know, also in this chapter, he says, although all inventories are alike in principle, the time factor does distinguish one from another. And I just like this thought that all inventories are alike in principle. In principle, they're the same. Of course, he's talking about whether you do something as a spot check or you stand back and look at it. I think I don't have much more to say. It's interesting when you don't, you know, kind of plan your talk and you just do a live, you know, counterpoint. I do turn to people quite a bit. I kind of get lost in my own head. You know, I do 10 steps with Rachel, my wife, and she's like, well, I know you, Jason, and it seems like you're doing this again. And that's incredibly valuable feedback. And I'm not dependent upon Rachel for that. I have other people that know me well. And when I have people come to me, you know, and they say, Jason, should I do this or should I do that? Or I'm thinking this or I'm thinking that. You know, what do? I don't know. Pray about it. And in order to pray more effectively, sometimes I have to get rid of and kind of, it's not processing, it's not therapy, it's, oh, I'm being selfish like this, oh, I'm being fearful because of this, oh, I think there's a resentment kind of feeding it. It's just naming, moving on. You know, step four says fact-finding, fact-facing. It's not therapy for me, and then I turn to my higher power. And how do we really get in touch with our higher power? And how do we submit and surrender to God's will? You know, we pray, we ask for an intuitive thought or decision. And what is my conscience saying? What is that intuitive thought or decision that comes up after praying? And I think we forget that sometimes. Like the answer to the problem is, you know, sit with God, ask for that answer, follow that intuition. But yeah, I don't know if I'm making sense, but again, you're really, really making me think and really making me think about what this specific word says and what does Bill mean. And yeah, he does seem to point more towards, you know, this is a sort of a in my mind, solitary self-reflection process. So I'll just kind of put a pin in that and see if Pete, if you have anything else to say, and then if not, we'll open it to questions.
Well, look, I went about 6 minutes. Thank you, Jason. So I went about 6 minutes over my 20. I'm not going to go on and on. I just want to say this. I love Overeaters Anonymous. I love being abstinent. I love walking with pride and dignity. I love working towards being the kind of man that I think my God would have me be. I am not discrediting or talking down or saying anybody's doing anything right or wrong. I'm only pointing out what our literature says we are supposed to be doing in working these steps. Again, I'm going to reiterate, do them whatever way you want to do them. Do them whatever way works for you. But there are specific instructions that we're supposed to be passing on to people, and those specific instructions came from 5 years of several alcoholics running through what the right way and the wrong way was to work with another person. And this is what they came up with. The big book was rewritten 4 times, right? 4 times. It was proofread. It was fact-checked. It was other people. It wasn't just one person writing it. If it needed to be changed, it would be changed. If we needed to add punctuation where punctuation doesn't exist, the punctuation would be added, right? So if we're going to study what the literature says, I really think it's incumbent upon us to talk about what it says versus what the narrative is relative to the program of recovery, what the general mindset is, right? There are, and that's it. I'll pass. That's all.
All right. Thanks to both gentlemen here. So I think it's time. We got time now to open it up to questions, and questions only for both Jason and Pete. So what we're going to do, and then we'll get their contact information at the end of the recorded hour. So if you have a question, one question only, please. I want to unmute and give me your first name and last initial.
Natalie S.
Tina S.
Natalie?
Tina S.
Hi, Tina. Gotcha.
Harry Beth.
Harry Beth, was that?
Yes.
Okay, got you, Terry Beth.
Hannah Yetta.
And Hannah Yetta.
Chris G. in Tennessee.
Chris G. Let's go one more. I don't know how we'll if we'll get through all of them, but if there's one other person, by all means, give me your name.
Sherry M. in Wyoming.
Okay. Let's stop with Sherry M. So we got Natalie, we got Tina, Terry Beth, Hannah Yetta, Chris G, and Sherry M. And we'll start with a question from Natalie. Good morning, Natalie. Press star one, Natalie.
Oh, there I am.
There
Sorry
you are.
That.
Good morning. That's okay.
Yep, here I am. Thank you to everyone, and I'll be as quick as I can. So this is Natalie S. in Indiana. And I appreciate the way you both kind of left the big book definition so that it allows God to interpret it at different times. And my question is this. If there's a spiritual defect or a step 10 that keeps coming up, and so, for example, I'll just speak for myself, and I've asked God to remove it, and he hasn't removed it yet. Can you explain a little bit about that experience for you? Is it like I've been surrendering my will as best I can? I'm asking God. I'm going to him. I'm doing the 10 steps. I'm practicing the principles, and it's not gone. And it gets to be really frustrating. And so if you can speak to that, I would be grateful. And that's my question. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
I can share a little bit. I this is a favorite question of mine, and I'll try to be brief in case Pete needs to jump in. And by the way, if people have a question for Pete or myself specifically, I'm happy to hear that addressed specifically. This is where, for me, sometimes thinking of step 10 as a continuation of steps 4 through 9 is important, right, or makes sense to me. So in those descriptions of 6 and 7, it says if we're not willing to have a character defect removed, we ask until we're willing. So if there's a resistance in me to, let's say, you know, I worked with a coworker who really triggered me, there's a unwillingness to kind of let go and find acceptance and love for that person, I pray and ask God. And by the way, when you ask that question, I ask, where does it address this in the big book? And I don't think it does. I don't have the knowledge of a place where it says you do inventory, and if it doesn't shift, you do it again, or if something's not resolved, you do this, or you go left, or you go right. So this is my best answer. So we ask God that it be removed. The other thing for me I found is, again, this book says action and more action. If I have a character defect and I don't find a way to make a change and sort of the spirit of step 6 and 7 to change my behavior, to change my attitude, and to be, you know, to bring that to God, those character defects tend to repeat and reoccur. One example is healthy conflict, right? Fear of conflict came up in my first four-step inventory, like massively throughout the whole thing. And it became to a point where not saying something was really harmful and not being able to share my point of view in a mature adult way. So when I did my step 10s and there was fear of conflict and I prayed, I would often get the intuitive thought or nudge, go talk to that person. Hey, you know, you did this. I felt this way. What was going on for you? Let's talk about it. So I'm going to kind of put a pin in that, and hopefully that's helpful. And Pete, you can jump in if you want.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, right? So what does the book say, right? So I love this is one of the challenges with considering step 10, steps 4 through 9. This is one of the problems, right? Because when does it, nobody ever says, well, I had an issue and I did a step 3, or I had an issue and I did a step 7. Nobody ever said that. It just says, well, I do a step 10, right? But it's not those things. And with step 7 says it in the prayer. It says, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. So if you have an issue and it's still sticking around, it means one of two things. God has a use for it, or God doesn't think it's standing in the way of his usefulness to him, or I need to go back and revisit my moral inventory. I need to go back and do a deeper dive into my, you know, my resentments, my fears, and my relationships or sexual conduct with other people. There's something I didn't uncover, right? That I have to be. So it's either God has a use for it, or you have more discovery to do.
Okay, thanks for the question, Natalie. Next up is Tina, and then we'll go from there to Terry Beth. Tina, good morning to you.
Hey, thanks so much for your service. And I'm walking. I hope the traffic doesn't disturb everybody. But I just wanted to thank both of you guys so very much. You know, it reaffirms my experience on step 10 in OA and on step 10 in AA, which I'm grateful for. But my question is to both of you, daily, do you think about how many 10 steps you're going to do today, and do you count them? That's it.
I have a 5-second answer to that, which is no and no.
How about you, Pete?
Thanks, Tina. Okay, step 10, it doesn't say we do every day. It doesn't say that. It says we do it when selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear crop up. If it doesn't crop up, there's no need to do it. And why, like I said, it's not an event. It's a process. Why would you count them? Why would you count them? All day long, when I experience something that's unsettling, I ask God to remove it. My 10th step's done. I ask God to remove it. Right? People are not the proxy for God. Having a discussion about it is only more self-centeredness. And the book tells me I have to get out of me. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of my problem. The more time I spend on me, the more time I spend in the problem. You know, I have a pretty rigorous meditation practice. sometimes in the middle of my meditation practice, I get a thought to myself, what the F am I doing this for? I'd much rather get up and make my breakfast or play with my kids or do something with my dog. I don't get up and make a phone call to somebody and say, you believe I have this thought. I sit and I observe and it passes, right? The moment I focus on it and attach to it, the bigger that problem becomes. You know, so no, when these pop up, we ask God to remove them. It doesn't say it's daily, because sometimes it just doesn't show up. Other times it shows up way more than others. And when it does, I do what the book instructs me to do. I ask God to remove it.
Thanks, Pete. Dang, I got to get
Thanks
rid of
so
my
much.
Abacus and my spreadsheet. Peter. We're not a glum lot here, right? Hey, Terry Beth, you got a question. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello, Terry. Good morning.
Yes, this is Terry Beth from Dallas, Texas. So it says accept him immediately. So what I've done is sometimes I make amends and I'm still pissed off. So I was told, or I heard an OAer say, we have to first, you know, pause and have some serenity or let go of that resentment. So I'm a literal person, and when it says immediately, I'm thinking I've got to do it immediately. But I'm finding that I really need to pause or release to see my part, release some of that resentment, because otherwise it's going to come out. So my question
Terry Beth,
is,
do you have a, if you could, oh, there we go. Thanks.
My question is, how do you, handle this when, to release your resentment before you make amends? Well, how do you handle this immediate word?
Is that question for both of us or just one of us?
Whoever wants to answer, whatever God wants. Yeah, it could be both.
Well, I'll just jump in, and then give Jason an opportunity. Look, what's it asking us to do? Right? We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed someone. Harm is a different, it has a specific definition, right? It has a specific definition. That means if I've materially or physically damaged or impacted someone. If I've physically or materially damaged or injured someone, I have to address it immediately. I don't need to ask somebody if I took $40 from somebody to have them how much I have to give them back. That's what a harm is. And amends has a specific a definition, right? Amends is not apologize. Apologizing is asking for a pardon. Amends is repairing or doing reparations. That's what amends is. So if you harm someone, in the beginning we might have to say, what should I do about this? But at what point in time do we grow? At what point in time do we learn? At what point in time do we get better and recognize that we can make amends with just our God-given intellect and fix it? That's it. Pass.
Yeah, and for me, I just wonder, you know, pause when agitated or doubtful, you know, make amends immediately, do things quickly. You know, I wonder if in the 1930s, their definition of that was a little different, you know. And I wonder what a pause can be. Can it be a breath? I heard another AA speaker say, you know, a person would get kind of frustrated at a certain meeting and stop going for a week or two. And was that a pause? Was that them pausing because they're agitated and doubtful before engaging in that meeting? So, you know, for me, I look at how long is that pause, and, you know, making amends, restitution, right? You stole $40, you know, you You know, you hit somebody's bumper with your car, you give them your insurance information, you'd be mad at yourself all day long, you know, frustrated, you know, at yourself, right? And sometimes I ask God, remove this resentment towards myself, and it just keeps pinging in my head. And sometimes I reach out and I ask for a little bit of help with that, with another person. And again, Pete is making me think, is that just more self-centeredness? I don't know. It doesn't feel like it. But I think it's a good question that you ask. If you're still angry, how long do you pause? So I'll just kind of share those thoughts, and yeah, that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you so much, Terry Beth, for the question. Next up, Hannah Yetta with a question. Good morning.
Excuse me. Good morning. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you, Jason and Pete. Thank you so much. You've done an abundance for me this morning. My question was really answered, but I do have another, and I wasn't going to ask two, so I get to ask the second one. So if the same resentment keeps coming up over and over, you do 10 steps, you just do a God check, you do all these things, it seems to be okay, you feel relieved of that, you feel closer to God, but it keeps coming up over and over and over. Do you suggest going back and doing another full fourth step? What are your suggestions? Thank you.
Guys, either one, well, and both.
Yeah, well, I think I like Pete's answer earlier. Maybe that's useful, you know, useful to God somehow. I also try to get myself out of this mindset, I've done this 10 step before, right? Well, maybe I have, maybe not. It's a different day. You know, it's a different day, right? It's a new experience. It's this present moment. Sometimes, like in relationships, you know, work, professional, friendships, or intimate, you know, there's patterns, right? And those patterns involve certain character defects that I enact again and again. And I have to pray, and I have to, you know, meditate. I have to do some self-examination. And maybe that is more, like Pete said, a moral inventory, maybe doing some writing. My last fourth step had a lot of stuff about my relationship with my wife, and there were patterns, right? Now, looking at that, I've seen the patterns really clearly, and we've made some really specific commitments and actions to do something different. When I do something different, I get different results. I don't experience the same fears, anxieties, you know, that selfishness is not triggered. You know, my pride isn't triggered in the same way, and we are living a new experience, and that's very wonderful. But like Pete said, and this topic and is process. It's a continuation. It's a continual kind of watchfulness and asking God to remove defects of character, which leaves me listening more to my higher powers' guidance. I'll stop there.
Yeah, it's good. Thank you, Hannah. Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. You know, it's a question asked earlier, right? And like on page 76, it says it, right? It says, I pray that you now move from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. It's up to God to figure out what's useful or not. It's not up to me. And if it's still there, maybe it still has some purpose. And if it doesn't, just take a deeper look, another deeper dive into my moral inventory. And that's what the process calls for. Thanks, Anayeta. Okay, next up, Chris G. Good morning, Chris.
Thank you.
Chris, we may have lost you. Press star one again. Okay.
Now can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now, Chris. Thanks so much.
Okay. Yeah, I was talking away. Thank you, everyone. And it shows me that I have a long way to go, and I have a long way to grow. And I thought about, well, what did I do this morning? And the first thing I thought about this morning was a cup of coffee, and I wanted a cup of coffee. And that was the most important thing. And so
Anyway, my question is, when you're shown a character defect, can you just be shown one at a time, or aren't they always related to another character defect? You know, aren't they intertwined? And that's my question.
Yeah, to me, that fear, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment seem to almost always be part of the equation. I'm not sure it's necessarily important to analyze that question, because if they're there, we're asking God to remove them, right? Whether it just feels like a fear, a terror, right? It's only fear. I can't identify selfishness, you know, or it's just dishonesty, resentment. Still, God, remove this fear, right? Direct my attention to who you'd have me be. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, so, again, this is step six, the essay on step six that's written in the AA 12 and 12, again, 13 years after the big book was written, because there's not a lot of information on step six in the big book. It tells us that our defects of character are really a result of our instincts, our own natural basic instincts that have become out of proportion. And the fact that makes them defective is that they've gotten bigger than they're supposed to be. And when we're asking for a defect to be removed, we're not asking for the thing to be removed. We're not asking for the instinct to be removed. We're asking for the defect, the fact that it's not in the right proportion, to be removed. It's supposed to be worked down, right? Or when it's removed down to the natural God-given way it's supposed to be, right? So asking God to remove fear, that's never going to happen. All of our defects, selfishness, right, dishonesty, resentment, fear, they're all part of our basic instincts that have come out of proportion. They're all the instinct for the social instinct. We're not supposed to have too much social instinct. We're not supposed to have too little social instinct. Right? Safety. We're not supposed to be too safe. We still need a little bit of excitement and danger. It's supposed to be a balance. And what happens for us is they become out of proportion. So what we're doing, Chris, is we're asking for the defect to be removed. We're not asking for the instinct to be removed. So what we have to do is go to God, and we have to ask for guidance and direction. The hardest part of this program is not believing in God. The hardest part of this program is trusting and relying on God. And many of us want to rush in and do the work that God's supposed to be doing. And that's not our role. The role is to guide people and direct people to trust and rely on God. And with that, I'll pass.
All right, let's finish up with the last. Thank you, by the way, Chris. Question from Sherry Ann. That'll be our last question. Sherry?
Hi there. Thanks so much, Larry, for your service. Sherry, I'm gratefully recovered in Wyoming. Thank you, Jason and Pete. Thought-provoking as usual, and I got so much out of it. I have a two-part question. If we can get to both, great. If not, that's okay. Because in the big book, it talks about that we are recovered after step 10, isn't it true that if we're doing 10 steps or sharing 10 steps with people who are not yet recovered, we're leaving ourselves open to spiritually sick feedback because we haven't yet straightened out spiritually? That's part one question. Secondly, in step 10 in the paragraph, it says that we make amends quickly. And if I'm old school where we went through the steps in order and I didn't do amends until after step 9, but if you're saying it's okay to do amends when, you know, to do this step while you're on step 4, isn't that leaving it open for people who are not familiar with the step process and don't know about their defects, that they're going to people making apologies and they may just be 1 month away from making a formal amends? Isn't that causing more harm to people? Thank you.
Do you get all that, guys? If you did, you're a better man than me, but those were good questions, I think.
Yeah, Pete, if you want to take a crack at it, I don't have a clear answer.
Yeah, as setting aside everything everybody else thinks they know and setting us and focusing on what the literature says it is, we're not seeking feedback. That's not what we're doing. You're talking about an outreach call, and many of the things that people are calling a 10-step is just an outreach call. That's all you're doing. We're supposed to be getting guidance and direction from God. That's where we're supposed to be getting guidance and direction. Again, don't get me wrong. I love the fellowship. Almost every person I associate with is in recovery in some capacity. Regardless. But what I'm saying is that that's not the role. That's not the role. The role is to be getting guided and directed from the one that has all power. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Is it helpful? Absolutely. Does it feel good? Yeah. But guess what? Peeing in a diaper feels good too initially because it's nice and warm. It surrounds your genitals with warm fluid and it feels good. But eventually it gets cold and uncomfortable and not the way we're supposed to be, right? So just because it feels good to get guidance and direction and insight from our fellows doesn't necessarily mean it's good. That's it.
Okay. Wrapping up, what about you, Jason? Any insights on any of that?
No, I'll leave it with the diaper metaphor. Yeah. Thank you.
Right?
Thank you.
Hey, I really sincerely want to thank both you gentlemen. Appreciate lots of different things, and we're learning all the time. So from this book and from good people. But anyway, let's go ahead and close. We'll stick around. We'll get both Jason and Pete's contact information at the end of the recorded portion. So let me close with page 164. We have a reading here. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the